In October, Governor Kathy Hochul signed legislation designed to protect employees in New York from the possibility of retaliatory actions by their employers if they blow the whistle on illegal or dangerous business activities, specifically addressing a loophole in the protections afforded by the state's existing laws, according to proponents of the new measure. To understand who and what type of situation is covered by the new whistleblower law and what it means for employers, we're joined by Alan Scheuhetbrod, managing partner of the Albany office for the law firm of Tully Rinke. Welcome to the show, Alan.
Good morning.
So prior to this new law taking effect, what protections are already afforded to New Yorkers who want to report illegal or dangerous activities at their place of work and not get in trouble for doing so?
So the whistleblower statute in New York has been in place for many decades, but it's always been very narrow. It's codified under the labor law, Section 740. It's been limited in scope and application. Not a lot of cases have been successful under the previous version of the statute. Not a lot of employees are actually very aware of the statute and the protections, but what it did protect is actual disclosures or actual violations of public health and safety or healthcare fraud typically. So there's really two statutes here, 740, Section 740 and 741. 740 really has to do with the health and safety aspect. 741 is the healthcare aspect, but it's always been very narrow in scope, not very successful, not a lot of protections, unfortunately, on the old statute. It's been known to practitioners that this is not a great statute to really litigate on, but with the new law, it's been dramatically expanded and has opened up the protections and who's protected and what really may be a disclosure under the amended statute.
Is the narrow scope that we operate under now a product of just time? You mentioned how the law is decades old. Is it simply outdated and not reflective of the situations that might arise and warrant protection, or is it just narrowly written?
I think it's just narrowly written and narrowly applied. The case law has not really expanded upon what the protections actually encompass. With most statutes, with how they're drafted, it really comes down to courts on how it's interpreted and how it's applied. So I think it's a combination of how the statute was effectuated, the lack of really any amendments to it for a long time to expand those definitions and those protections, and then the courts not really expanding beyond that.
Were there some sort of cases, potentially with the Court of Appeals, that set a precedent early on, say years ago, that has really set the direction of this, and maybe we could have had a completely different interpretation of the law if the Court of Appeals had ruled differently, say, many years ago?
Yeah, I mean, the Court of Appeals for the state obviously is the highest state court. The courts, their job is to review and to, you know, to basically enforce these laws and how they are applied. The Court of Appeals could have expanded it depending on the situations, but courts tend to kind of stick with the narrow facts that they have and really just apply the law to those facts. But it's just historically the way the cases have been going is that, you know, these 740 cases, there's a lot of, or at least previously, there's a lot of conditions to establish what is an actual disclosure, what is an actual violation. And because it was so narrow and so narrowly applied, it was very rare, at least in New York State, for a plaintiff to be successful in that outside of the healthcare context. I think in the healthcare context, it becomes a little more direct with regard to healthcare fraud and with regard to, you know, potential Medicaid and Medicare payments and those sorts of aspects under the state law. But with the amendment now, it really is in line with other states and kind of the federal law on the expansion.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're talking about an expansion of the state's whistleblower protection laws, and our guest is Alan Scheuhetbrod, managing partner of the Albany office for the law firm of Tully Rinke. Well, what are the practical effects of Governor Hochul signing this new bill? Is there additional classes of employees or additional types of whistleblowing that will now be covered?
There's a lot of things here. So first of all, the law goes into effect within 90 days of signature. So I believe it's January 26, 2022, which is pretty soon. But the categories, so historically it only applied to employees. Now it applies to current and former employees and also independent contractors. So it opens up the individuals that are able to blow the whistle. It also expands on what is protected. I think one of the big things is types of employee activities that are now protected. So previously, as indicated, Section 740 was a narrow statute that really barred employees or employers from taking retaliatory actions against their employees where an employee had disclosed or threatened to disclose to a supervisor or a public body an activity, a policy, or practice of the employer that is an actual violation of law, rule, or regulation that creates or presents a substantial and specific danger to public health or safety or constitutes as healthcare fraud. So on that prior version of the statute, an actual legal violation had to have occurred. So a reasonable belief that a violation had occurred from the employer, their reasonable belief that a violation had occurred was not enough. That's changed. So the new definition actually does include a reasonable belief. So an activity that the employee or the former employee or the independent contractor reasonably believes is a violation of the law. So it essentially protects and bars employers from retaliating against workers or independent contractors that have actual knowledge of a violation of law, rule, regulation, or have a reasonable perception of that employee that there was a violation of these things happening. It also broadened the definition of what a retaliatory action actually is. So 740 has always barred employers from taking retaliatory action against their employees who engage in these protected activities. Under the prior statute, that was defined as discharge, so someone who's been terminated, a suspension, a demotion, or some other adverse employment action, usually something that impacts the terms and conditions of one's employment. Under the revised statute, retaliatory action has been defined and expanded to include actual or threatened adverse employment actions, actions that would adversely impact their current or future employment. Reporting, for example, someone's citizen or immigration status of not just that employee, but also if they're family members or someone in the household. It also lengthened the statute of limitations. One of the big problems with the prior statute was the very short period of time that the whistleblower had to commence an action in court. So previously, it was a one-year statute to commence an action. Now it's a two-year statute. There's also additional forms of relief. Previously, Section 740, the whistleblower was really only able to obtain injunctive relief, so enjoin the employer from violating the law, reinstatement if they were terminated or discharged, the reinstatement to their position, and any sort of back pay. Under the new law, they may now be entitled to recover front pay because it's not always feasible for someone who has been terminated as a result of their whistleblowing and being retaliated for that to go back to their job. So now the statute has recognized that and has the ability to provide relief in the form of front pay, also punitive damages. So if this was a willful violation that occurred from the employer, there might be punitive damages or liquidated damages that are applied. The civil penalty also went up to $10,000. And one of the big things, in my opinion, is the previous law did not provide for a jury trial, but the new law does. So now a jury of your peers can review the substance of the claim should it go to trial. So those are the big aspects. One additional aspect that employers should be aware of is the notice requirement. So the previous law did not have a notice requirement. It did not have one of those conspicuous posters that, you know, we typically see or we should see at most employers with regard to someone's rights under the FMLA or someone's rights under EEO bases for discrimination. Now, however, there are notice requirements and employers are required to make their employees aware of their whistleblower protections, rights, and obligations in an area that's easily accessible and that is typically frequented by employees and other applicants.
So does that mean the old break room sign where there's usually the minimum wage law postings and other news that employees might need to be aware of?
That's right. Yep, now there's going to have to be another poster, another notice indicating what their rights are under the whistleblower statute.
So there's a lot to unpack in what you just described. And I want to start with that reasonableness standard. You know, looking at the bill, it seems to me that employees can now report on malfeasance or illegal activity, dangerous activity, that's maybe beyond their scope, things that maybe they aren't necessarily involved with. Because of that threshold, is it possible that they might think something is going wrong and they might reasonably believe that, but because this is so far outside of their scope that their reasonableness isn't actually that meaningful, then will this potentially prompt people to report things that they don't actually know anything about?
That's a real possibility. You know, what is a reasonable belief, right, is one. You know, that's probably going to be a big aspect of the litigation, whether, in fact, this was a reasonable belief and how that's interpreted. Secondly, I see no preclusion from employees who essentially don't know specifically what the violation is itself or whether or not they're working in the field to have the knowledge underlying what that violation is to be precluded. I think what the statute actually does is really opens it up for these individuals to make these disclosures and then to preclude them from being retaliated as a result of these disclosures. So I see no real narrow aspect as to if the employee doesn't actually work in the field but still has a reasonable belief that disclosure is happening, that they are precluded from these protections. I don't read the statute that way, but of course, we'll see how the court handles that.
And after a quick break, we'll continue our discussion about the expansion of the state's whistleblower protection laws with our guest, Alan Scheuhet-Broad, managing partner of the Albany office of the law firm of Tully Rinke.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
In case you're just joining us, we're continuing our conversation about an expansion of the state's whistleblower protection laws with our guest, Alan Scheuhet-Broad, managing partner of the Albany office for the law firm of Tully Rinke. When we talk about whistleblower protections, does it matter who an employee is blowing the whistle to, whether it's the media they're going to or state or federal officials?
Previously, it was a requirement for them to at least start internally to raise the issue to management or their supervisors. And that still kind of is in the statute, but there are exceptions to the amended statute. If there is an imminent and serious danger to public health or safety, if they reasonably believe that reporting the improper aspect of what's happening to the supervisor would result in the destruction of evidence or concealment of the activity, if the improper activity could be reasonably expected to lead to endangering the welfare of a minor, there's certain categories that take away that sort of requirement that the employee or the former employee or the independent contractor would have to bring it to management or the supervisor. And really, it has to do, for the most part, imminent. If there's something that may happen immediately that will have a significant consequence, they're not required from raising it internally. There might be other aspects that employees should be concerned with, you know, those who have sort of security clearances or some kind of confidentiality aspects that they need to be aware of as to whom they disclose to. For example, going to the media, you know, could open up the doors for some other issues that may occur, but for the most part, the requirement has always been that you need to raise this internally first, but the amended statute has recognized that's not always feasible.
Based on what you said about the existing whistleblower protections, it seemed like the healthcare industry was one area where whistleblowers could expect a certain amount of protection. Are there certain areas under the new law that you're expecting to get a whole bunch of new whistleblower claims about, areas that might not necessarily have been as well covered by the previous law?
in the healthcare context, obviously there is a lot of media and press with regards to what's happening with the pandemic and COVID, with regards to PPE and with regards to potential claims that are made. That's something that needs to be tracked and probably will cause a lot of new complaints being filed with regard to what's happening with the vaccine potentially and what's happening with some of these recoupment of claims and the protection equipment. So I'm expecting to see a lot of complaints related to that in the healthcare context.
And what about outside of healthcare? Because it seemed like healthcare was the one area that had some protections already. So are there other industries or types of jobs, say blue collar, white collar, retail, that you think will be kind of ripe for utilizing these protections now?
It's hard to know because, you know, it's been so expanded that historically we've been seeing a lot of these claims in the healthcare context. But I do think that really any violation of law, regulation, or rule and the reasonable belief as such, it really is difficult to see what the trend is going to be. But I could see potentially safety is a big part of it. And maybe in the construction industry, for example, seeing a lot more of those types of complaints. But it's hard to know because it really does apply to every industry and, you know, really any sort of reasonable belief of a violation is occurring or may be occurring.
We've been having this conversation through the lens of private businesses, but does this apply to people who work, say, in New York State government or municipal governments and their protections if they report any sort of potential illegal or dangerous activity? Or are there other laws that protect them, or are they out on their own?
It would apply to municipalities, state, arms of the state. There are other protections under the civil service law. There's protection under the federal law and the False Claims Act. There's obviously Sarbanes-Oxley federal statute. I mean, there are other statutes that may apply, but certainly this would apply to the state as well.
And these types of protections are to guard against an employer retaliating against an employee. But do you have any sense that the protections now have swung the pendulum so far that an employee could essentially weaponize complaints against employers that they don't like? Are the protections so broad that this gives a embittered employee a free shot at an employer they might not like?
It's hard to know what the motivations are, right? That's why I think what the issue is going to be is that reasonable belief standard and how that's going to be interpreted. At the end of the day, anyone can file anything at any point. The employer is sometimes required to take a look at that. I think from the employer's perspective, they need to take a look at their handbooks and do whatever they need to do to comply with the statute and ensure that every complaint that comes in, if it comes in, needs to be handled impartially and appropriately.
And is there a difference between reporting illegal or dangerous activity compared to reporting activity that might just be unethical or unpopular?
Yeah, again, going back to that reasonable belief, but what the law requires is that there is, at least right now, an actual violation of law, rule, or regulation. Now the amendment is going to be a reasonable belief of a violation of law, rule, or regulation. So an ethical violation doesn't necessarily mean it's a violation of law, rule, or regulation. Something that's unpopular may not be a violation or a reasonable belief that there's a violation of a law, rule, or regulation. So just because something is unethical, immoral, or unpopular doesn't make it illegal.
You mentioned earlier how courts have traditionally taken a narrow reading of the existing whistleblower protections, in part because they were so narrowly written. How could courts in the near future potentially affect the implementation of this new law?
They might be hesitant to do so, and they might just interpret it on the face of the law and look at the legislative history, the assembly history on this. They might also look at other states. And, you know, for example, New Jersey has a comparable statute with comparable protections like the amended statute. They might look at other jurisdictions and see how the law was applied in those jurisdictions, because this is new, you know, has been expanded. The definitions have been expanded. You know, we're going to see a whole new form of case law coming out from New York State as a result of that. So typically what would happen is they'll look at other states and look at similar or comparable cases and see how those were applied and interpreted, and at that point how the judges would feel or apply the law in this particular case or whatever particular case it is. And then if it goes up on appeal, you know, those appellate courts typically look at the law itself, not really the factual component that led to the violation. So I would expect that it really is dependent on what the disclosure is and what the retaliatory action is, why the amendments occurred, and looking at the history as to what led to the amendment, and then looking at other jurisdictions and other cases and seeing potential comparable violations and comparable facts and seeing how that was applied in those situations.
And finally, you mentioned how the law takes effect in early 2022. If I'm a potential whistleblower and I bring something forward after that law takes effect, but it's in regards to activity that happened before the law took effect, which system am I protected under? Is it the previous statute or the new statute?
I would presume that it would take effect when the complaint is made. So as long as the complaint is made after the effective date of the statute, if the factual component of what the violation is or the reasonable belief of the violation occurred prior to the amendment, it's going to be up to the court to decide whether or not that falls under the amendment and the protections thereafter. But it might, you know, court might look at it from when the complaint was actually raised.
Well, we've been speaking with Alan Scheuhet-Broad. He's the managing partner of the Albany office for the law firm of Tully Rinke. Alan, thank you so much for taking the time and giving us all this pro bono legal advice.
I wouldn't say it's legal advice, but thank you. Thanks so much.
You heard that, listeners.
Support for the Capital Press Room is provided by Destiny USA. Shopping, dining, and entertainment all in one location. For more information, go to www.destinyusa.com.